Welcome to Are You Quizzing Me? I am Vineet Nair with my co-host Aditya Kashyap. This is a quizzing trivia podcast show. Join us as we dive deep into history, science, pop culture, and so much more. Let's get quizzing. And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, for episode number 62 of your favorite quizzing and trivia podcast show, Are You Quizzing Me? Aditya and I are back for another round of quizzing. Let's start off today's episode with the audience question, which I will answer at the end of today's episode. So X is a dish that was invented in Canada by a Greek immigrant who was inspired by Chinese food to put a South American ingredient on an Italian dish that is now most popular in Australia. Let me repeat that for you. This dish was invented in Canada by a Greek immigrant who was inspired by Chinese food to put a South American ingredient on an Italian dish that is now most popular in Australia. However, this is not named after any of these places. What dish am I talking about? I will reveal the answer at the end of today's episode. Now, as to the question that Aditya had asked last week, let me hand over the baton to Aditya.
Vineet, I asked last week which movie has been named after food accidentally, just like Dabang, the Bollywood hit, was somehow also the name for Korean coffee and tea shops. So, here's the answer for this week. We have a few answers this week. We, of course, had Anda Apna Apna, which is also the name of a restaurant. So, if you like eggs your own way, you get Anda Apna Apna. Obviously, there is Grill Se, like if you like a food grilled and you want it directly from the grill, you say Grill Se. Of course, Aja Nacho Le, like if you like your nachos. There is Khane Bhi Do Yaro, because of course, you want to eat, then you want to eat. And I believe my favorite out of all of them is Bake Up Sid. Because why not? In this case, I do have to credit a certain individual, Sayandan Guha, who came up with these food-based puns. I found these online, so I can't take credit for these today. They're all Sayandan Guha's recipe for disaster, I guess.
Okay, fair enough. Let's move on to the serious portion of today's quizzing, because I frankly don't have anything to say after listening to those puns. Aditya, why don't you start us off this week?
All right. Do you know what the repository for germinal choice is all about?
The repository for germinal choice. Is that the question? Yes. Or is it the kind of prelude to the question?
Let's call it a prelude.
Okay. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but I would guess it would have something to do with seed banks. Preserving biodiversity when it comes to seeds or something like that.
I love it when you make unintentional puns, Vineet. And I'll tell you why. Because this is a sperm bank that was operating in California from 1980 to 1999.
Okay.
What was special about it? It became popular. It got some level of notoriety, I guess. What was special about it? That the founder of this sperm bank advertised as being unique about this sperm bank. It was founded by this person called Robert Clark Graham.
Okay.
What was so unique about it?
Okay, first off the top of my head, did he have like, or did he advertise that he had sperm samples from celebrities and top scientists and people who are the doyens of their field or something like that?
you are dangerously close to the answer. So oh. I'm just going to push in the right direction. Yes, it is about specificity from a certain group of people who are allowed to donate to this bank, I guess.
Okay. Are these people who don't want to have children of their own but don't want to waste their reproductive potential and are so donating?
No, and that would be tough to enforce, I imagine. But in any case, you were much closer with your previous guess.
Okay, with the celebrity thing.
Yes, you also mentioned something else.
sports people, people who are scientists, or high IQ people?
Oh, very close, very, very close. So I'll give you maybe a couple of more shots at this.
Okay. Wait, so these are not Mensa members in particular. That's not the answer. These are not like people who are not members of high IQ societies. Okay, so not in particular, maybe high IQ societies in general, like Prometheus and whatnot?
Not high IQ societies, no. Let's say these are people who have a certain achievement, accolade.
Oh, Nobel Prize winners.
You're right, yes. This is a sperm bank that was intended to be only for Nobel Prize winners, recipients of the Nobel Prize. Except that non-Nobelists also did donate. But it was famous as the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. It was initially called the Hermann J. Müller Repository for Germinal Choice, named after Hermann Joseph Müller, who was a Nobel laureate from the 50s, I believe. Turns out that even though Robert Graham went around talking big game about how this will be a high IQ sperm bank, it wasn't the case that there were a lot of Nobel Prize winners who were attached to this.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Sounds a little sus, to use the Gen Z terminology. Yeah, sus.
It was very sus because Robert Graham was also a eugenicist. Oh. And there were three people who were attached to it, two of whom pulled out. No pun intended. Pulled out once this place got notoriety, and only one known Nobel Prize winner who was associated with it who did donate once, apparently. So that was the case. The media made a huge furor over it, this whole eugenicist sort of, you know, bent to this thing. Do you know which TV show references this particular sperm bank?
A particular TV show?
In its pilot episode.
Oh, wait. This is the Big Bang Theory. They try to make money by going to a sperm bank.
It is the Big Bang Theory. The first scene, I believe, is Leonard and Sheldon visiting the quote-unquote high IQ sperm bank.
Yeah.
And they're also based in California. And they intend to donate specimens. And Sheldon later feels bad because what if he committed genetic fraud by donating sperm that may not produce a genius offspring. Yeah. So, yeah, that was how from 1980 to 1999, there was a quote-unquote Nobel Prize sperm bank that was operating in California.
That's nice. Great question. I'm going to move on to something related to music, or at least the Grammys. So, X has been nominated for a Grammy 9 times. And has won 3 times. He has won last in 2019 and was 94 years old and was the 3rd oldest person to win such a Grammy. He was a prolific author, spent more than 30 books about his life, career and experiences, subjects ranging from international affairs to a recollection of childhood Christmases. So who are we talking about?
When was the last Grammy?
2019.
And he was 94 years old.
He was 94 years old.
Also the author of multiple books, you said.
Yes, more than 30 books.
I can't think of anybody who jumps to mind right now, so.
Okay, I will give you a clue which may immediately get you the answer. He led the effort to eradicate the guinea worm parasite in developing countries. He has often been stated as saying that he hoped to live longer than the last guinea worm parasite. And it's a testament to his effort that in 2021, only 14 cases of guinea worm parasites were recorded, as compared to 3.5 million in 1986. So you can say he's been pretty successful.
I have a vague feeling that this is Jimmy Carter.
Haha, you're right. It is President Jimmy Carter. He's won 3 Grammys. All spoken word Grammys, but 3 Grammys nonetheless. 3.
Wow. Okay. Now, I remember this was for an audiobook that he got the last one for. That's what I remember.
Yeah. Yes. My next clue was going to be that the position of power that he held, he's often regarded by many as not having been one of the best. And to be fair, he also lived during that transition period when the world was moving towards a much darker context. So he was president during the embassy takeover in Iran, when what we consider today as modern day terrorism rose his head. It wasn't a good time for him.
So Jimmy Carter was just before Bush Sr., right?
No, Jimmy Carter was before Reagan, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, right, Reagan was.
So it'll be Carter, Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, Bush Jr. or W, then Obama, then Trump, then Biden, and then God knows who's going to be next.
That's a pretty cool question. Interesting. I had no idea that he won a Grammy three times.
Yeah, three times.
Because when you first asked that question, I was like, oh boy, I'm going to struggle with this because I'm very bad at music trivia. But lovely. Speaking of America, I want to know, do you know what overprints are?
Overprints? Not specifically, no.
Okay. So the idea of an overprint is an additional layer of text or graphic added to the face of postage or revenue stamp or a banknote or a ticket, perhaps. That's called an overprint. So there'll be the standard format that any of these officially issued pieces of paper or...
Yeah. No, I understand now. Yeah.
Okay, great. So that would be an overprint. Do you know why America issued overprints on a bunch of dollar bills, including the $20 bill, with the name of a specific state on it?
With the name of a specific state?
Yeah.
Was this during the American Civil War?
No.
Okay, so it's not one of the Confederate states. Did it happen when they changed a particular state's name? Did this happen after the acquisition of Alaska?
Also no.
Okay, then you'll need to give me...
I'll give you the name of the state. It is Hawaii.
Okay, Hawaii became a state in the 50s, I believe.
Slightly earlier, if I'm not wrong. I retract that. Hawaii did become a state post Pearl Harbor. It was part of the United States of America before that, obviously. But it wasn't granted statehood then.
Okay, yes. TK. So then it was...
That was 1959.
1959. I remember something about it being in the 50s. And then I'm like, okay, fine. So it's not, wasn't a state. Can you give me a time frame as to when this happened?
That would be a very easy clue then. So before I give you that, I will give you something else. The intention behind doing the overprinting was to render the note worthless.
Was this because they were afraid of a Japanese invasion and they didn't want the Japanese to get US currency, which they could use as a foreign exchange and have more dollar bills in their hand? You know, you don't want your currency in the hands of your
enemies. Yes, you are absolutely right. You got that very quickly. The fear was that the Imperial Japanese Armed Forces might invade Hawaii and capture a bunch of these banknotes and unnecessarily contribute to the enemy's war effort, I guess. So to make sure that these dollar notes were recognizable immediately, the United States of America decided that they're going to print Hawaii on top of them during World War II. and if they were caught or if they were being used by the enemy, you would be immediately made aware that they should not be considered legal tender anymore. So, yeah, the Hawaii overprint note was a series of banknotes issued during World War II. And it was an emergency issue after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So, specifically, that's why I didn't mention when it was. Because I didn't give it to you too easily. But, Vineet, you cracked it nonetheless. So, well done.
Yeah, so I actually am in the middle of watching a World War II series. It's called Masters of the Air, which is a companion piece to... Band of Brothers in the Pacific, but this is specifically dealing with bombers, B-17 bombers flying out of England, bombing Germany and Europe in advance of the invasion. So I was watching that. So World War II is in the forefront of my mind right now.
Isn't it always? It is your Roman Empire.
Okay, yes, I actually got that reference, so yay me. Let's go to sport. Right, let me give you a sport question, because I rarely if ever ask a sport question, right?
So go for it.
This type of field goal was first tested at the collegiate level in 1945 in a game between Columbia and Fordham, but it was not kept as a rule. It was just a test. There was another one-game experiment in 1958 in a game between St. Francis and Siena. It was adopted across all professional and collegiate conferences, leagues, and associations in phases all throughout the 1980s. The use of this type of field goal has become more frequent in the modern day, particularly from the mid-2015 onwards. This increase in the past few years has been attributed to one single player, who's credited with revolutionizing the game by inspiring teams to regularly employ this type of field goal as part of their winning strategy. What type of field goal are we talking about?
Field goal is an interesting choice of words. I just want to clarify, are we talking about football?
No. Field goal is the official terminology.
Okay.
That is used in the official books and whatnot. However, we would know it by slightly different names.
Okay. And you haven't mentioned the sport yet.
I have specifically not mentioned the sport, because that would be a dead giveaway.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Because I was assuming it would be hockey or ice hockey or something along those lines. But now
Fair guess, but no.
Yeah, now I'm thinking it isn't a sport with goals in general. So
technically not true, but not untrue either.
That is unhelpful in the worst possible way.
Yeah, it is true, but not true at the same time. Keep that in mind.
No, don't. I will categorically refuse to keep that in mind, because it only confuses me further. So yeah. I'm going to go with my assumption. And my first guess is not even the answer of the question, but rather the sport itself. Is it cricket by any chance?
No, not cricket.
Okay. Because
in cricket, you can categorically say that there are no types of goals, right? There are no field goals or any kind of goals of that kind. This sport has a goal-like system.
Okay. All right. So it does have something like you would know as goals. Okay. Because I was very, very curious if cricket has goals too. Okay.
No.
Except for Hardik Pandya's goal to win.
Ugh.
Oh, look at us, Vineet. We have grown so much. Making cricket jokes now. Asking sports questions. Making cricket jokes. Our listeners should be proud. Okay. A sport which has a goal-like feature. I don't know why Quidditch comes to mind, but 1950s.
No, Quidditch obviously does have goals, right?
It does have specifically goals. The 1950s would be pushing it. So, until this is a fake history of Quidditch through the ages.
You never know.
No, I'm going to assume it's not the case.
No, it's not. But then I like to stir the pot.
Goal-like features. Boy, I don't know. I'm so confused. Basketball?
Close. Not actually close. Yes, let me say. It is basketball.
So unnecessary, Vineet. Okay. Basketball and field goal. Would it be a three-pointer?
Yes, it is a three-pointer.
Okay.
So what we call as baskets or points, they're technically supposed to be called field goals in the official terminology.
Interesting.
And so do you know the player? So I had mentioned in the question that the increase in the use of this particular type of field goal in the latter years has been attributed to one particular player, who is credited with revolutionizing the game by inspiring teams to regularly employ this type of field goal as a part of their winning strategy. As in, don't just use this as an opportunity, use this as a part of a winning strategy. Do you know which player I'm talking about?
You know, I know this piece of trivia because I remember hearing about this. Oh, no, it's even escaping me where I heard about it. But yeah, the fact that three-pointers should be a big part of the game instead of just a once-off thing. Oh man, I'm not so good with the basketball names also. It's not
okay, Kobe. I'll give you a clue about the player. This player's name is the same as a dish with a sauce seasoned with spices mainly associated with South Asian cuisine.
South Asian? A dish seasoned with sauce? That is just every every dish in South Asia.
Yeah, dish with a sauce seasoned with spices mainly associated with South Asian cuisine. What would you call such a dish?
Kobe beef. Kobe. Brian. I'm trying to think of what other Asian. Well, Kobe is not Asian. South Asian, but it's Asian.
No, the name just happens to be the same. It's like a Dabang association. It's not intended to be that way. Okay, like if I told you there's like the name of a type of dish is the same across India, Indonesia, Singapore, even Japan. What name would you think of? Like the same name you'd see here, there, everywhere.
That would be oyster sauce.
Jordan. No oyster sauce in India.
Oh, I was thinking first names. Do you mean Steph Curry?
Yes, it is Stephen Curry. So Steph Curry is who's inspired. He's like a regular three-point machine. So like he's one of the few basketball players I know of. So that should tell you how famous he actually is.
I'm on first name basis. I call him Steph. I don't even call him Stephen.
You call him Steph. So this three-pointer was not part of the original basketball rules, right? It was first tested in 1945, but not kept as a rule. Then they experimented on it again in 1958. But at the time, there were problems with defining how far across what line, because there were different courses, different basketball courts with different sizes where the length was different. So it wasn't kept as a rule. And then throughout the 80s, it was all standardized and made common across all leagues, associations and conferences. And finally, it has become a standard rule now. And since 2015, since Steph Curry has become this major player, it has also become a part of creating a winning strategy during a game.
Cool. That's a fun question. All right. I did not, especially the field goal part. I love that. Okay. Speaking of goals in the classic sense.
Okay.
Football, which takes me to Brazil. And we have segue. My next question is from Brazil. So, the right to dash, just like there are Bill of Rights for most countries, Brazil has a right to dash, which is colloquially called the right to dash, and is in the healthcare system, is something that has become a sort of a cultural export from Brazil or a cultural identity of Brazil, because they do offer the right to dash. This is something that came to be because of a guy called Ivo Pitanguy. In the late 1950s, Pitanguy, who is now known as the Pope of Dash, convinced the president that the right was as basic as any other health need. Can you tell me what the right is that is pretty unique to Brazil?
I am going to give you a number of guesses because I have no clue what this is. And when you mentioned Brazil and being a cultural export of Brazil or an export of Brazil, a lot of things come to mind. Right. But what's really throwing me off is that you said it's part of the healthcare thing. So the right to something is a healthcare thing you're talking about.
Adjacent, I guess you could call it that.
Healthcare adjacent. Okay. First guess, I have no expectation this will be right, but is it the right to drink coffee?
Oh, that's a fun guess, but no.
Because Brazil is one of the largest exporters of coffee in the world. Okay, second, knowing Brazil would be the right to play football. I don't think that should be a right, but still, like, what else are you talking about Brazil? No, okay, it's not football. And again, I don't know, that's not health adjacent unless you count injuries due to football. Wow. The right to samba?
Oh man, I really wish that countries had the right to a specific kind of dance. But no.
No, okay. I am lost. Oh, wait. Is it peyote or one of those hallucinogenic drugs that there are a lot of these Amazonian tribes which do that. It's not peyote. Peyote is Mexico. There's one specifically in Brazil and South America. Ayahuasca. Yeah, that's what it is. Is it that?
No, it's not ayahuasca either. All right. So let me tell you a little bit more about this. Let me give you more descriptive details. In most of the countries, including India and the United States, any other country, I believe, this particular part of the healthcare industry would not be subsidized.
Oh, is this plastic surgery?
That's right. It is plastic surgery. So do you know what the right is?
The right to boob jobs.
That would be too specific.
Okay.
Think more generic.
Wait, the right to beauty?
The right to beauty is something that is guaranteed to Brazilians. And this was because of the efforts of this one specific guy who's considered the Pope of plastic surgery, Ivo Pitanguy. And he argued that the right to beauty was as basic as any other health need. He made the case that ugliness caused so much psychological suffering in Brazil that the medical class could not turn its back on this humanitarian issue.
Wow.
In 1960, he opened the first institute that offered plastic surgery to the poor. And Brazil has a massive number of very qualified plastic surgeons because there's a huge demand in the country. It has become sort of a cultural export or definitely a cultural identity. Like you mentioned, breast enhancement surgeries are very common over there. And other plastic surgeries are also common enough. And you would not be paying out of your pocket. Insurance would cover it because it is considered medically necessary and not merely aesthetic.
Okay, no wonder you have so many good-looking Brazilian people.
Do you want to take a guess as to how many surgeries are subsidized by the government every year?
Oh, I would not be able to. Let's say a few million?
No, it's half a million. It's half a million. Surgeries every year are subsidized by the government.
Oof. It is a strange world.
It is the world we live in.
Yeah.
And you cannot make this up.
If somebody put this in a movie, the critics would be like, this is so unrealistic. This would never happen. Like, I guarantee if you do it now, even with Brazil having it, most people would say it's unrealistic until you point out that this actually exists in a country like this.
All right. Vineet, hit me.
Okay. So this is regarding something in particular, something very specific. Okay. They created a special packing case which could minimize vibration and ensure that it would never come into contact with another surface. To increase security, the case had to be small enough to be easily carried by two men, but impossible to be carried by only one. Okay. Moreover, the case had to be unsinkable in the event it had to be thrown overboard into the sea. They also had the French flag painted on it to show that it was French property, because they worried that without the markings, maritime law concerning the salvage rights of property retrieved outside territorial waters might allow it to be wrenched from the possession of France. After reaching the destination, they also insisted on a bank vault with an independent air conditioning system, and in the case of a labor strike or loss of electricity, it would need to be connected to a hospital or the Pentagon. What was carried inside this case?
Did you give me a time frame for this?
No, that is next. That's my first clue. See if you can get it without that.
Something from France going to the United States of America. I'm assuming it's not the Statue of Liberty.
Or no, any parts obviously. Of the Statue of Liberty. Yeah, no, because they said it is a case which had to be carried, which can be carried easily by two people, but should not be carried by one. Or it would be impossible to be carried by only one person.
That's very interesting. It could easily be carried by two, but cannot be carried
by one. Yeah.
Huh. That is such a fun description. Because I can't think of a single thing. Forget the other clues. I can't think of a single object in the whole wide world that would fit that description. Can easily be carried by two, but cannot be carried by one.
The case. We are talking about the case that is carrying. The case is designed so that it can be carried easily by two people, but cannot be carried by one. That does not necessarily mean that the object inside would fit that same description.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. That makes it slightly vaguer, I imagine. But is vaguer even a word? No, yeah, I have absolutely no clue. Give me either the time frame.
I will give you a time frame. The time frame is 1962.
Okay. Not sure if that helps me. Was it some sort of an award or?
Not an award.
Okay, give me what space am I thinking of? Am I thinking arts, entertainment, sports, politics?
Arts, entertainment, yeah.
Is it some sort of movie memorabilia?
No. Though 1.7 million people did queue up when it arrived and was used. Not used, let's say displayed.
Oh, did the Mona Lisa come to the US?
Yes, so it is the packing case that carried the Mona Lisa from France to the US and then back to France. So they had displayed it in the US between March of 1962 and from December of 1962 to March of 1963. The French government lent it to the US to be displayed in New York City and Washington, D.C. In New York, an estimated 1.7 million people queued up so that they could see the Mona Lisa for all of 20 seconds. Each person was allowed 20 seconds to see it. What I find really ironic about it is they had the French flag painted on it to show that it was French property.
Yeah, you don't want that disputed. What do the French have if not the Mona Lisa? And I guess baguettes and miming that you have
Mona Lisa. Croissant. Croissant. Let's say croissant.
Croissant. Croissant. That's true. Though it is disputed whether it is from France.
Yeah, there was this thing. I think people were saying it's also from Austria.
Yes.
Yeah, so then possibly that's not. But then French cuisine at least is from France. We can definitely say that. Escargot. Snails. From France. Champagne from France.
I have a friend who works in the culinary space in food, and she has argued that French food sucks. So her argument is that French bakery goods are great. So anything that's baked, yeah. But everything that's considered the high branded
hot cuisine.
Hot cuisine is actually quite garbage. I don't completely agree, but I do see...
Neither do I. I think it's a matter of your palate. If you're used to a Southeast Asian, South Asian or East Asian palate or even African palate, it's very difficult to appreciate French food because it can seem very bland.
Yeah. I think they have few ingredients and they make those ingredients shine. They don't have as much of, I guess, variety in terms of spices and all whatnot. But that's for another time. That's for another food episode, I imagine.
Yes, yes.
Okay, Vineet.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of old things.
What?
Mona Lisa old now. Mona Lisa is old, come on. Also, sorry, before I ask my question, the whole 20-second thing. I went to the Louvre and I stood near the queue. I didn't get into the queue to view the Mona Lisa. It seemed like the most ridiculous thing to queue up for, just because the queue is super long and you barely get any time in front of it.
It's very small. I've seen photographs of it, like in the context of the room. It's very small.
It's tiny, and there are huge, beautiful paintings in that museum. Well, I guess it is. It is what it is. All right, yeah. But speaking of old things, let's move to my last question and the second last question of this episode. And here I have to warn you that this question isn't technically a great trivia question, but it is a phenomenal piece of trivia. So,
okay, fair enough.
Bear with me if the question doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay.
What is common between the rings of Saturn,
okay,
Polaris, the North Star,
okay,
the Atlantic Ocean,
Wait, what?
Wait for it. Wait for the last one. Trees.
What? Wait, we're talking about the rings of Saturn, the North Star, the Atlantic Ocean, and trees. Not any specific tree, just all trees.
Trees, all trees.
What? I cannot even get a starting point. Polaris, the rings of Saturn. Wow. Anything to do with Atlantis? Atlantic Ocean, Atlantis. But then trees, what do trees have to do with Atlantis? Wow, this is just weird. And Polaris is... Okay, are we talking about the star Polaris or the North Star? Because the North Star keeps changing every few 10,000 years.
We're talking about the star Polaris.
The star Polaris. Wow. What we call Dhruv Tara, right?
Yes.
Oh, God. I have nothing. The Atlantic Ocean, the rings of Saturn, and trees. Wait, are these all things that James Cameron changed in the second cut of Titanic?
Oh, man. That is a great...
No, technically, that may not be wrong. There must have been a tree somewhere in the film, I'm guessing. He might have added it or removed it. The Polaris and the Rings of Saturn, when he changed the night sky. And he might have also changed the special effects for the water. It's a right answer. You cannot say this is wrong.
I will consider this the unofficial second answer to this question.
Okay.
Yeah, but it isn't the answer I was looking for.
Okay. Give me a clue. What should I be looking for? Is it etymology related? Is it mythology related? Is it something else? What is this?
It is in the space of science. Okay. And specifically, let's say, the animal and plant kingdom. Let's be even more specific. Wow. It's one species.
A species is common to the rings of Saturn, Polaris, the Atlantic Ocean, and
trees? It's not common to it, but all of these things relate to that species in a very specific way.
Okay.
To be fair, these are not... I'm using the word species rather non-scientifically. So it's not... Okay. I'm not sure if it's a specific species or it's...
Wait, are these something to do with dogs? I'm spitballing here.
Polaris dog. No, that's a good guess, but no, it's not. It's
not the Sirius. Sirius is the dog star, not Polaris.
Yeah.
Okay. Ooh, pigeons or doves is something which navigate...
No. All right, let me give you specifically how they're related to that species. I have tormented you long enough.
Okay.
All of these are younger than a specific species.
Ooh, then in that case, I would have to go with sharks.
It is sharks. These are all things in the universe younger than sharks. So I'm sure there will be a bunch of other animal and plant species also out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Older than this. Bacteria, viruses, I'm sure are much older. But in this case, I was just amazed by the idea. And I did know that sharks are older than trees, just because trees came onto land much later and then sharks had been around for a while. Even that trivia might blow some people's minds. It is a phenomenal piece of trivia. Polaris, and I don't mean Polaris became the North Star after that. Yeah. I mean the star is younger than sharks. The star has not been around for as long as sharks have been around.
Yeah.
That to me is freaking insane because sharks have been around for 450 million years.
Yeah.
And Polaris...
And they've changed relatively very little, except for size. They've changed relatively little.
Insanity. That is absolute insanity because a shark is a pretty... a complex being and to think that was around before us. You know what else is in the realm of sharks as a species lifetime? I'll tell you. So Saturn rings, I mentioned, are younger.
Yeah.
A lot of exoplanets are younger. There's this thing called the Boot Void, which is the largest known void between galaxies, which is 350 million light years. So technically, light can travel across the entire Boot Void and still not be as old as sharks.
Wow.
50 million years. oh, here's my favorite piece of this, all of this, right? So I mentioned the Atlantic Ocean is probably younger.
Yeah.
Trees are younger. Saturn rings are younger. And Polaris. A galactic orbit of the sun is only 200 to 225 million years. So the sun has gone around Milky Way galaxy twice in the time sharks
while sharks have been. Wow.
Sharks have taken two whole revolutions of the Milky Way galaxy.
And just look at the comparison between how long they have been alive, sharks have been alive, compared to humans. Like modern day humans in our current aspect, what, 40,000, 50,000 years?
I think
200. That's pushing it to the very extreme. Like when we're talking civilizations, maybe around 10,000 years. But 10,000. Humans as hunter-gatherers, maybe about 50,000 years or so. You might push it to a few 100,000 if you look at our previous, progenitor species.
It's very interesting because the Homo erectus was around for 2 million years. So even the Homo erectus has been like almost 10 times longer than Homo sapiens have been around. So it is insane. But 200,000 years is the maximum, I believe, that Homo sapiens are estimated to have been around. Compared to 450 million years. That is...
Yeah.
What is that number?
I've read a couple of these, kind of mind, your perception of time changes, right? So, Nintendo was around when the Ottoman Empire existed.
Oh, yeah.
Warner Brothers was around when the Ottoman Empire existed. You could actually write a historically accurate pastiche of Sherlock Holmes going to Japan and buying trading game cards of Nintendo.
that is true. So there are more modern day things also which are in the same realm. Picasso was around the time that Indira Gandhi was alive. Like somehow that to me also doesn't make as much sense because Picasso seems somehow much older, but he was around. And if you go slightly longer, I think a common one that people might have heard is Cleopatra is closer to us in history than she was to the pyramids of Giza.
Yeah.
There is another one which blew my mind, and this is much longer. The T-Rex is closer to us than the Stegosaurus was to the T-Rex.
Yes. I've heard the same thing. Yeah.
Is insane.
No, it's something I had mentioned something similar last episode, I believe. Last episode, the episode before last, where Claire Bloom and Charlie Chaplin, if you took their careers together, they've spanned three centuries. Three Gregorian centuries. Another one, which again will blow your perception of time, is that John Tyler was the 10th president of the United States. Okay? 10th president of the United States, which means he was born when Washington was president.
Okay.
And then he became president. Okay? John Tyler's grandson is still alive today. So John Tyler had a son very late in life, around 75 something. His son again had a son who was born very late in life. And the last time I read, this was in 2020, Harrison Ruffin Tyler was still alive in 2020. He was 91 years old.
Wow.
So he could say that his grandfather was born when Washington was president.
That's a flex. That is a flex, yeah. Wow, okay. But generally the TIL moment for the whole of last week has to be that sharks are older than
probably half the shit on Earth.
That is like before a single species had walked on land or survived on land, sharks had been roaming the seas for a while.
I think that's also part of why we are so fascinated with sharks.
Sharks, they are so very complex as creatures that it is.
And also really quite alien because you don't see any other fish, because sharks are not fish, but you don't see any other kind of aquatic or marine animal or whatever you want to call them, living being, which resembles sharks. Like, they have their own identity and it's very separate from everything else.
Ooh, and of course, Jaws.
Yes, Jaws. And Shark Week. Okay, let's move from sharks to the theater. There are two actors. Let's call them X and Y. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're famous for playing the same character. Both of them are famous for playing a character, and it's the same character. These two actors starred on the London stage together in 2011 in a production of Frankenstein. It mm-hmm. was directed by Danny Boyle. And what was unique about this play was that X and Y would alternate between playing Victor Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster. So if you went on a Monday, you would see X playing Victor Frankenstein and Y playing the monster. And the next day, the same play would be played with Y playing Frankenstein and X playing the monster. So what ended up happening is X and Y shared the Laurence Olivier Award and the Evening Standard Theatre Award for Best Actor in a Leading Role for their performance. I want you to tell me, if you know, who these two are. Obviously, I've left out a major clue, which I will give if you don't know off the top of your head who this might be.
No, I do know that it is Benedict Cumberbatch, but I'm not sure who other actor is.
Okay, so then you know which same character they've played, right?
Probably Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, so it is Sherlock Holmes. One of them is Benedict Cumberbatch. Can you tell me who the second person was?
I have no idea who the second person was, no.
Okay, would it help if I told you that this person also played Sherlock Holmes on television?
Oh, on television. There was that American version of Sherlock Holmes also.
Okay.
But no, I have no idea. Yeah.
You've not seen, okay, the show's name is Elementary. Does that help?
Elementary, yes. No, I just know that there's a show called Elementary. I have not watched it. I don't
know. Oh, you've not watched it. Oh, okay. No. Okay. The actor, the one I'm talking about, was once married to Angelina Jolie. Last chance to get it.
No, I have no clue as who. And I remember his face and I can't recall his name.
So it is Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch. They both played Sherlock Holmes on TV, one in Sherlock and the other in Elementary. And they both starred together in a stage production of Frankenstein. And I think it's a brilliant concept. I think it's a brilliant concept to have the same like actors alternating between these two roles. Because at the end, at the core of the story, and this is my personal take on it, is that who actually is the monster? Is it Frankenstein or is it the creature that he created? Who's the monster? So having actors alternate between those roles kind of, you know, drives home that thing. And it also is from a financial point of view, obviously, if you want to watch Frankenstein and you go watch it once and you see Benedict Cumberbatch playing Victor Frankenstein, you'll want to come back and see how Johnny Lee Miller does it.
No, makes sense. Yeah. Smart choice.
So from a financial viewpoint as well.
I just remember this piece of trivia because Benedict Cumberbatch and this other guy playing both the roles. Yeah, you're right. Like as a financial point of view. And even if you're a fan of just one of those actors, you want to watch that actor play the other role also. So you want to come back and watch the show again. So it makes sense, yeah.
So that was my last question and the last question for this episode. Aditya, what is your question for next week?
Okay, so my question is... since you mentioned Frankenstein, I want to ask you which two actors from the Indian film industry should play the same character, same iconic character, if there was ever an adaptation of that character to stage. I don't know why or how I'm going to arrive at this answer, but there will be an answer ready for you next week. So which two actors would be perfect to play the same character from the Indian film industry?
Okay, I'm grateful. I'm not the one coming up with that answer. But moving on to my question from the beginning of this episode, our audience question. How many of you have cracked this? This dish was invented in Canada by a Greek immigrant who was inspired by Chinese food to put a South American ingredient on an Italian dish that has gone on to be most popular in Australia. However, it's not named after any of these places. What dish are we talking about? Do you have any clue?
That's a great question. Is it named after some other place or is it not named after any place at all?
The name is the same as that of a place, but it was not technically named after the place.
Oh, so the name is it like Hong Kong noodle or something?
Similar, but as I mentioned, it's invented in Canada by a Greek immigrant inspired by Chinese food to put a South American ingredient on an Italian dish that became most popular in Australia.
South American ingredient on an Italian dish became popular in Australia. No, yeah, I have no clue.
Okay, this is the Hawaiian pizza. So the, how do I put this? Very divisive act of putting pineapples on a pizza was first done by a Greek immigrant by the name of Sam Panopoulos in Canada. He was inspired by the complex interplay of sweet, sour, spicy in Chinese food to put pineapples, which are technically a South American origin ingredient, on an Italian dish, which is pizza. But now the place in the world where it's most popular is Australia.
Wow, I had no clue that.
What is funny is it was called Hawaiian pizza, not because of the island of Hawaii, because that was the name of the brand of canned pineapple that he had in the restaurant.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's pretty cool. Nice. Yeah, some pineapple didn't occur to me when you said South American ingredient. But yeah.
I know. That's why I just love. I took this out of a. There was an article, I think, in the New York Times or one of the larger newspapers where the journalist had written exactly this line.
Makes sense.
But it's really divisive. I saw this YouTube video of this guy going to multiple pizzerias in Napoli, in Naples, and asking them to put pineapple on the pizza. Let's just say the Italians weren't very on board with that particular request.
Is it the same guy who went around asking for ketchup when he ordered pasta? Because I know there's a guy who did that also.
I think it's the same guy.
Okay.
Wow. Okay, so what's your pop culture recommendation for this week, Aditya?
I'm going to do YouTube channel for this week. And because I was reminded of this channel because we're talking about sharks and the universe and things that are old and ancient and impressive. And this would be PBS Eons. PBS Eons is a YouTube channel, which is a very interesting channel. They are simple. They don't do very complex graphics as many other infotainment channels on YouTube do. But this does have a thorough scientific, I guess, research backing it. Or at least seems to me. I'm not a scientist, so I can't claim that it is thorough. But seems to be pretty thorough. Mm-hmm. And they do tell great stories in 10-minute videos. So check it out. And there are some very fun topics that they cover. Right. From dinosaurs to modern day humans and their histories.
Oh, that's great. My recommendation for this week is related to my recommendation from a past episode. So if you remember, I had mentioned Benjamin Stevenson's book, Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a sequel to that book, which the last episode I'd mentioned that I'd bought and was in my reading list, called Everyone on This Train is a Suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, it rocks. The book is fantastic.
Okay.
It is truly fantastic, and I would recommend it to everybody, anybody who enjoys a good comedy book or a good mystery, because it's a solid mystery. Because I believe that a good mystery writer should be able to put all the clues in front of the audience and then reveal the answer. Many times what happens is there will be some odd clue or something that is off screen or is not told about, and it's a deus ex machina or some kind of thing that comes up in the end, and they're like, oh, it is because of this that this person was the killer. But no. Here, in the chapter right before the complete reveal, the author or the narrator actually lists all the clues for you one more time.
Nice. Okay.
it's a fantastic book. I would highly, highly recommend it to everyone else. And something that Aditya and I were discussing earlier about how long humans have been, how long Homo erectus was there before Homo sapiens took over and things like that. I was reminded of a line from a TV series that I saw recently. It's called The Three-Body Problem on Netflix, where during one particular episode, a character, I'm not going to spoil who, basically asks them, how long did it take you from fire to the wheel, from the wheel to the Industrial Revolution, from the Industrial Revolution to the Information Age? So it's like shortening periods of time. So I was reminded of the same thing. We walked erect for 2 million years, and then we became hunter-gatherers, then we became an agricultural society, then we became civilizations, and then the Iron Age, Stone Age, and then finally Stone Age, Iron Age, the Bronze Age, medieval times, and now we have moved so quickly from the information age to what I'm now calling the age of AI.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what our children will see.
As long as what they're listening to is this podcast, I'm okay with
everything. Aha! Nice plug. I like it. So that's all for today's episode. Thanks everyone for listening in. We hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you learned something new, because frankly, there was a massive TILs for me in this episode. If you like what you heard, please, please subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Take 2 seconds after I finish my spiel to give us a 5-star rating and subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you're listening to us on. It helps us reach a wider audience and allows more people to discover and enjoy the show. We'd love to hear from you. Feedback, suggestions, trivia, even questions you want asked on the episode. Just send us an email at areyouquizzingme@gmail.com. with the name of the quizmaster who you want to ask the question in the subject line of the email. We also have a subreddit, r/areyouquizzingme. And you can also reach us on Instagram at areyouquizzingme. We appreciate your support and look forward to sharing more episodes within the future. Thanks again for tuning in. Have a great day.
See you guys next week.